By the turn of the new millennium, neo-soul had well been introduced into music with artists like Lauryn Hill, Maxwell, Jill Scott, and Brandy at the forefront. But the true king of neo-soul, in my humble opinion, is none other than the musical mastermind himself, D'Angelo. This being his sophomore album, he wanted to take more risks and make the funky jams he always wanted to make. But what he didn't expect was the major image shift that he was about to experience after the release of his music video for the song untitled How Does It Feel? The song and video that turned him into a sex icon for the rest of music history. So let's dive into this musical genius that is the Voodoo album. And after revisiting the album, you all can tell me, how does it feel? From pop stars and boy bands to alt rockers and rappers, the 2000s had a bit of something for everyone. So it's no wonder that decades later, the same power of the music released has been so strong. I'm Michael Kadosh, and I want to welcome you to my musical time machine, where I deep dive into some of the best albums released in the 2000s. And I may even be joined by some special guests here and there. This is Planet 2000s. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Planet 2000s podcast. I know it's been a couple weeks and I took a little time off, but I'm back and I'm here with this brand new episode for the album Voodoo by my favorite R&B artist, Neo Soul King, D'Angelo. This episode, I'm going to be joined by a very special friend and coworker. We work together at eTalk, but he also is quite the music aficionado. His name is Alex Flaubert, and we are going to speak to him in just a little bit. But you know how it is here at Planet 2000s. Before we bring out the guests, we give you a little bit of history on the album. And today is no exception, so let's get into it. Voodoo by D'Angelo was the second studio album released on January 25th, 2000. Through Virgin Records and produced primarily by DJ Premier, D'Angelo, and Rafael Sadiq. It was D'Angelo's magnum opus. It is his magnum opus. It was all recorded at Electric Lady Studios in New York, which was the Jimi Hendrix studio. And the album is Soul University. It really is. Like, the education that you get about music through this album is incredible. The first sessions for Voodoo were in 1996, so this album was a four-year accumulation of recordings in the styles of R&B, hip-hop, and jazz jamming. Every recording session was done with drummer and producer Amir Questlove Thompson of The Roots, and you guys may know him because he works with Jimmy Fallon on The Tonight Show right now, but he is a music king and music genius, and he was with D'Angelo by his side through the entire process of making the album Voodoo. He and his crew studied bootleg videotapes of classic R&B artists such as Marvin Gaye, James Brown, and Jimi Hendrix, along with reruns of Soul Train at Electric Lady Studios, which is the Manhattan-based recording studio that was built by Jimi Hendrix. Frequent visits to the studio were made by fellow neo-soul and hip-hop recording artists that were associated with the Soulquarians Collective, which is a collective with a bunch of amazing neo-soul R&B artists and producers, musicians. D'Angelo was a member, and Erykah Badu, Q-Tip, Talib Kweli, James Poyser, and Mos Def were members as well. In 1998, D'Angelo was inspired to write music again after the birth of his first child, Michael, with fellow R&B artist Angie Stone. He traveled back to the South and spent time in Richmond, Virginia, which was his hometown, and South Carolina, and reconnected with the Black music history that had originally inspired him because he was experiencing quite a lot of writer's block after the first album.
We recorded the whole album at Electric Ladyland, Jimi Hendrix's home and studio. And when we went there, I mean, we really got into the whole, you know, vibe of that place and of Jimmy, you know. And I believe the spirits were there, you know, like helping us and guiding us, you know, do what we did.
Everything that happened after Brown Sugar came out.
Meaning,
like, I went on tour and I basically didn't know how to handle or to accept everything that happened. And then too, just seeing everything. Because before you get into the business, you really don't know what it's about until you get into it. And then, you know, once I saw it, you know, once you rub heads with snakes and everything like that, you know, you get jaded. So I kind of got jaded, you know. And I had to return, or at least mentally, return to why I wanted to do this in the first place. And that was because of my love for the music, right. You know, and until I got to that place,
On his visit to South Carolina, D'Angelo stated that he went through this rental through gospel, blues, and a lot of old soul, old James Brown, early Sly and the Family Stone, and a lot of Jimi Hendrix, and that he learned a lot about music himself and where he wanted to go musically. After he released his Live at the Jazz Cafe album in 1998, which was a live album, he began really writing and focusing on recording songs for this record, and the album became Voodoo. He had his daughter Imani in 1999 as well, so he included both of their names in the album's liner notes. And in a press video that was accompanying the release of the album, D'Angelo suggested that he was attempting to kind of create a new sound for him that was in transition, and he said that his inspiration was just to go farther and to get to the next level.
The main goal and the main object is to come out with an outcome that feels like we didn't use all this technology, or, you know, we did it back in the day, you know. So, you know, certain techniques have to, you know, be done for that. You know, we mic the instruments a certain way. We mic the amps in the hallway or, you know, in the bathroom to get a certain sound from the bass, you know. And, I mean, we was thinking about that a lot, you know, just in terms of how it was going to sound, you know. We didn't want it crisp or clean sounding. We wanted dirty, you know.
Now, originally, he had no plans to follow up the uber-successful album Brown Sugar. He wanted to focus on just producing and creating music and not necessarily promoting it. He said the death of Biggie and Tupac affected him greatly in this hiatus period as well and contributed to this inspiration to want to create music again, you know, a follow-up record. Now, he also said that he had to retaliate why he was doing music in the first place, and the reason was for the love of it. He felt R&B had become way too mainstream, too pop, and thought there needed to be a return to its true forms, and he added true funk and soul, and he didn't want to do the mainstream radio formula. Then, you know, we got this album, Voodoo. There were 5 singles from the album: Devil's Pie, Left and Right, Untitled, How Does It Feel, Send It On, and Feel Like Making Love. And obviously, you know, when me and Alex talk, we are going deep track by track about our feelings and facts about the album and every song, but I'll give you guys a little bit on each of the singles and a little bit on the Voodoo tour before we get to that. So, you know how it is. Let's get into Devil's Pie. Devil's Pie, the first promotional single that was released for Voodoo on October 31st, 1998, and though it was not an official first single, it was a little taste teaser that Virgin Records released to hype people up for the upcoming album, which wasn't quite ready at that point. This track was a departure from the more urban contemporary sound of the Brown Sugar album, including a more experimental R&B sound with funk, neo-soul, and hip-hop elements, jamming vibe, and this is the vibe that would eventually be featured all throughout the Voodoo album. The song was released on Halloween, but it was also featured on the soundtrack to the 1998 film Belly. The film was released on November 4th, 1998, and stars DMX, Nas, T-Boz, and Method Man. D'Angelo and DJ Premier produced the song, and DJ Premier had worked with Christina Aguilera on the Back to Basics album in 2006, so, you know, as a pop aficionado myself, it is quite exciting to me that he also worked on the Voodoo album. It's because they're quite different, but, you know, they both have lots of samples and lots of throwback elements, and when you think about it, it kind of does make sense that they're both DJ Premier. DJ Premier originally made the track for Devil's Pie for Cannabis, but he later offered it to D'Angelo, who wrote the lyrics over the song, and the song is just what you think it is: neo-soul, funk, hip-hop mix with psychedelic soul in it. It's so experimental, and it was a departure for him.
My music is an expression of who I am as a person. And me being an individual, you know what I'm saying, expressing myself through the music is going to be different, you know what I mean? I'm not trying to sound like everybody else, I'm just trying to be me, I'm just trying to express how I'm feeling.
The song is one of the more hip-hop oriented songs on the album, and it contains several, actually different samples, all mixed together. We have Teddy Pendergrass's And If I Had, Fat Joe's Success, Pure Henry's Jericho Jerk, Enie's Fakin' Jacks, and Raekwon's Interlude, among others. So we have literally 6 or 7 samples in this song. Lyrically, the song talks about the evil seduction of materialism in the world of hip-hop, and according to producer and drummer Questlove, the song was written to address the issues of the money-hungry, jiggified state of the world we're in, which you can't eat without dough, cream, ice, cheddar, and bread, the key ingredients, and how the devil will destroy those who will sell their souls to him. Now, D'Angelo comments on the image of prison and death that is used by hip-hop artists, and obviously it's very fitting for the movie Belly that it came from. D'Angelo also touches on the lack of artistic integrity in hip-hop at that time, and selling out. Lyrics like drugs and thugs, women and wine, 3 or 4 at a time, watch them all stand in line for a taste of the devil's pie.
I mean, we was in the studio jamming on stuff that we love, you know, as childhoods, things that, you know, that makes us reminisce about back in the day, and things that we love, you know. What's your favorite song, you know? Who your favorite artist? James Brown, Sly Stone, George Clinton, you know? backtracking and just basically having fun doing the music that we want to hear, you know, music that we love.
The song only charted on the U.S. Hot R&B Hip Hop Airplay chart, where it reached number 69 because, you know, it was more of a teaser for the album, as it was mostly attached to the soundtrack to the film Belly, so it wasn't really pushed too hard as a single. But he did perform it at the MTV Movie Awards 2 years later, so ironic that he would perform this song at a movie award show, but not in the year that the movie came out and it's from a movie. But hey, you know what? At that point, it was a part of the Voodoo album and the Voodoo album only, honey. The second single from Voodoo came a year after the release of the first, Left and Right, featuring Method Man and Redman. Given that Devil's Pie was more of a taster associated with the movie Belly, one could suggest that Left and Right was the official first single. Nonetheless, it was the second.
I collaborated with Redman and Method Man, you know, for Left and Right, for the single. Me and Q-Tip actually co-wrote the song together. Did some work, you know, with some very talented.
A perfect blend of hip-hop, neo-soul, and R&B, Left and Right features rappers Method Man and Redman, who also co-wrote the song. They wrote their own verses. It is a 70s music with a neo-soul twist. It's just funky, funky, funky. D'Angelo had been working with musical collective The Soulquarians for this record, and producer Dilla served as a frequent collaborator. And while he did work on both this song and the song Devil's Pie, he wasn't actually credited for his work on these tracks, at least according to him. Q-Tip was actually supposed to be the rapper featured on this track, but he was replaced by Method Man and Redman at the last minute due to creative differences, and Questlove, who then was a member of the Soulquarians, stated that the general opinion was that the song was cool, but nobody was feeling Q-Tip's verse, and a former A&R stated that D'Angelo's manager Dominique thought that Q-Tip's verse was whack. Yikes. Method Man particularly delivers a nasty verse, you know, pretty young thing got a tongue ring and a dirty mouth, and she whispering them sweet nothings, air it out. Ooh, goodness. You know, Redman even makes a TLC reference, saying in 1983, I was that scrub TLC talked about. Ooh. The rest of the song is basically D'Angelo singing about his girl and her feeling safe in his arms and safe to do it left and right and keep it moving up and down. Nasty, but in the best way.
Up and down. Yeah. Left and right, up and down.
Raw, funky, sexy, spiritual, blackness, not polished, not clean, you know, just real, just...
Now, there was a little reunion a couple years ago with Method Man, Redman, and D'Angelo on his verses. Things quickly picked up when, you know, both of them, you know, because the verses had been going on for a while, but then everyone got so excited because Method Man and Redman came back on and they did Left and Right, and then they also did Method Man's Breakups to Makeups, and the three of them grooved together for the performance, and D'Angelo was smiling ear to ear, hugging them as they left and said, give them their roses now, they're legends, kings. It's such a beautiful moment. One that you guys have to check out. The song Left and Right performed moderately on the charts, reaching number 18 on the US Hot R&B Hip Hop Singles Chart, number 44 on the US Hot R&B Hip Hop Airplay Charts, and finally, number 70 on the overall US Billboard Hot 100. Untitled. How does it feel? Me and Alex go in depth on this song, so I'm gonna keep this part of it a little shorter than I would because we are going deep on this, but this song is, it's inevitable that we have to talk about this. It's the biggest song of his career. It's the song of this album. The video was a movement, a pop culture movement. The third single and the first official mainstream radio single from Voodoo was Untitled, How Does It Feel? It was released on New Year's Day 2000, and it was the song that ushered D'Angelo into the mainstream pop culture stratosphere. The song was written and produced by D'Angelo and Rafael Sadiq and was crafted as a tribute to Prince, who was a hero of D'Angelo's, and the song has a vintage style and sound that is very similar to the early recordings of Prince's career. And as an homage to Prince, Voodoo producer Amir Questlove Thompson described the song as finding the line between parody and honesty in an era of the cover song. Redoing a Prince song was taboo. This is the second best thing. Questlove opens the song with offbeat on the drums, and it sounds so imperfect. It sounds like a purposeful fuck up, and I guess that probably is what it was to build up to the actual magic of the song once all the other funky instruments come in and D'Angelo starts to thing. And one thing I will never understand about this song, and Alex and I talk about it, is the way it ends just so abruptly, literally just in the middle of singing, how does it feel, mid instrument? Like, why? Well, you're actually going to have the answer why, because me, Alex, gave me the answer. I had no idea why it did that, but he let me know. So, you know, he's going to be schooling me. You guys are going to see. Lyrically, the song talks about a man's plea to his lover for sex. You know, the lyrics, love to make you wet in between your thighs because I love when it comes inside of you. I get so excited when I'm around you, baby. You know, it's just Marvin Gaye. It's Prince. It's, you know, it's graphic, but it's sung so beautifully that it's like, okay, yeah, you don't even notice what he's saying because it's just like pure lovemaking. And he needs to be with her. He needs to be inside of her. Damn, you know, passion. That's what R&B is about, man. Passion.
The idea, yeah, it was real simple. It was like, well, it's just you and the music. And I thought that made the most sense, you know what I'm saying? Because my whole thing is I want people to feel the music first and foremost. That's what I'm about. When the concept was brought to me about the video, being naked was part of the concept from the beginning. So, I mean, I didn't have a problem with it. He was telling me on the challenge to that area, go back to that church when you was there and you felt the spirit, you know what I'm saying? That's what I want to see. I want to see that. The set really wasn't that close. It was just the big camera that they had. You couldn't even see around it. You know, I didn't have to worry about anyone looking at me directly. You know, so I knew everybody was looking at the monitors, but you know, if they wanted to, they really couldn't see me, so it was cool. I felt comfortable.
The controversial music video was directed by Paul Hunter and Dominique Trinier, who was D'Angelo's manager at the time, and it was a muscular, sexy ass D'Angelo completely naked, a shot of him nude and lip syncing the whole song. It was Dominique's idea. He was wearing trousers, but it looked like he was naked. That was the whole point of it. Movie magic, you know how it is. And D'Angelo went under an intense physical workout plan to prepare for this video, working with trainer Mark Jenkins. In an interview for Spin, Mark actually discussed D'Angelo's reluctance of the video, stating that he said, you've got to realize he'd never looked like that before in his life, to somebody who was so introverted, and then in a matter of 3 or 4 months to be so ripped, everything was happening so quickly. You know, he didn't recognize himself. It was a new D'Angelo. And music fans were divided because some people were praising its sexuality and others were comparing it to objectification. And some male viewers claimed they were uncomfortable. I wonder why. Felt something, boys? Now, sorry to burst everyone's bubble. D'Angelo wasn't naked. When filming the video, he was wearing a pair of pajama bottoms, and they weren't in view of the camera. His appearance, it included a notable amount of sweating around the abdomen, and people, they thought he was getting head, and he talked about it in an interview, kind of egging them on, you know, saying like, no, I wasn't, but laughed about it, you know, so it's like, ooh. Maybe he was naked. You know, and Paul Hunter, the director, said that we made this for the women. The video, even with the backlash that it got tons of spins on MTV and BET, and it was one of the most, if not the most, polarizing video of the year 2000, and it had such a big impact on his career and his image, cementing him as a sex icon. But the thing is, D'Angelo didn't love this image, and it ended up taking a serious toll on his mental health. He wasn't ready for that level of fame and the attention that it brought him, and this led to a 13-year absence from the music scene that would follow the conclusion of the Voodoo Tour. And we're going to talk about this, me and Alex, quite a bit, so I'll put a cap on that part of D'Angelo, but it was a dark time for him after this because he wasn't ready for the amount of popularity that it got. The track won a Grammy for Best Male R&B Vocal Performance at the 43rd Grammy Awards in 2001, and it was also nominated in the Best R&B Song category that year. It has been named by Rolling Stone at number 51 on the list of best songs from the 2000s decade, and the song reached number 2 on the US Hot R&B Hip Hop Songs chart and number 25 on the Billboard Hot 100. So definitely the big, big hit from this album was Untitled, How Does It Feel? The fourth single from Voodoo was the soul track Send It On, written by D'Angelo, R&B singer Angie Stone, and his own brother, Luther Archer. The song was written in 1998 at a Virginia recording studio after the birth of his son with Angie Stone, Michael Archer, who was born in 1997. D'Angelo has two other children, Imani and Morocco, born in 1999 and 2010, so by the time he released this album, he already had two kids. The lyrics talk about honesty and faith in love, something he and the mother of his child were inspired to write about after having a baby. Send It On is a beautiful, languid piece of lover soul, according to the BBC. And the song, released shortly after the birth of Michael, D'Angelo's son, examines how love is actually an exchange of emotions.
In certain bands, they would get into the studio, you know, after they came off the road, you know, and when the band was doing good on the road, that's when they went into the studio and recorded. And, you know, if you messed up in the studio, you know, you just messed up, you know, it was just on the record like that, you know, and like, somehow that just puts the musicians on a different edge, and on a, you know, they play differently, you have different energy in the studio, and it comes across when you listen to the music, you know, And, you know, that was one of the things you wanted to get across, and that was one of the things you wanted to do. Like, I mean, keeping a mistake or keeping a noise that might, you know, technically, you know, in production, you might want to take out. You know, I don't know, just as a vibe, you know what I'm saying? That was my important, that was the most important thing to me, was keeping the vibe.
You know, my favorite lyrics from this song are, "You can't disguise your emotions. You know that I see in your eyes. Your soul's in me. Your soul's something that I feel inside. Run, 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 run. If I run, Lord, only knows how far that I will fall behind. Gotta find a better place, find a better space so that my life may be the reason why." Ooh. Deep. There are classic soul arrangements throughout the entire song. We have the fiddle horn, the trumpets. It's so romantic. It's so soulful. And I just want to light a joint and make out with my lover if I had one. If you're listening, whoever you are, let's make out to Send It On, please. There's a sample of Kool and the Gang's Sea of Tranquility. And D'Angelo showcases those classic falsetto vocals throughout this entire track. A little reminiscent of Sam Cooke, almost. Entertainment Weekly's Matt Deal called the song a stately soul ballad like they just don't make anymore. The music video is a compilation of live performance clips from D'Angelo's Voodoo Tour, and the song reached number 33 on the US Hot R&B Hip Hop Songs chart, and number 120 on the Hot 100, which is basically number 20 on the Bubbling Under charts. Feel Like Making Love was the fifth and final single released from Voodoo. D'Angelo covered the Roberta Flack classic on this album and turned it into a funk R&B neo-soul jam and released it as a single on April 8th, 2000 through Virgin Records. His version is more quiet storm and has a radio-friendly sound with the heavy use of multi-tracking for vocals. And originally, this cover was planned as a duet with Lauryn Hill, and they had collaborated on Nothing Even Matters from her Miss Education Lauryn Hill album. The song only reached number 109 on the US Hot R&B be hip-hop singles and tracks chart, because really by this point D'Angelo was checked out. He was on the Voodoo World Tour, and let's talk about that tour for a second, shall we? The Voodoo World Tour took place from March 1st, 2000 to October 20th, 2000, and it was done across 77 shows. The tour was sponsored by Levi's, and there was an ad featuring D'Angelo where the singer was promoting an end to gun violence, and the anti-gun violence organization PAX also agreed to sponsor the tour. And there was a wall composed of Levi's jeans that was available at all the tour stops, as well as petitions for fans to sign in support of anti-gun violence. D'Angelo's wardrobe during the tour included tank tops, black leather pants, and boots, so he was really giving us that R&B daddy vibe. Questlove directed the entire band, composed of mostly musicians who worked with D'Angelo in the actual studio sessions, and that's what he wanted. He wanted it to be real, authentic music, and he wanted the same musicians from the album to go on tour with him, to go on the road. And performances some nights went up to 3 hours a night, because he was literally just jamming with them, and it was in a love appreciation of music. The tour manager, Alan Leeds, who previously headed James Brown's late 1960s and early 1970s tours, as well as Prince's Purple Rain tour in the mid-1980s, called the Voodoo tour his most memorable gig. So he worked on Purple Rain, D'Angelo's idol, that tour, and he said that D'Angelo's tour was the most memorable one. Rolling Stone magazine called him confident and worldly in his performance, while also stating, "No wonder he's alive on stage now, dancing, touching the audience, slamming his microphone down, lying on the ground at the lip of the stage to sing One Mo' Gin while girls grab his legs, his stomach, and his crutch." And many critics compared it to seeing Marvin Gaye in concert. And the first leg, there was the openers Slum Village and Mos Def, and Lucy Pearl was opening on the second leg. And the tour visited the US, Canada, Norway, Sweden, Germany, France, Switzerland, Belgium, Netherlands, England, and Brazil. So you would think that D'Angelo was on top of the fucking world here, because he was getting such rave reviews and his talent was being held as one of the greatest, and it was sold out every night. But frankly, he was depressed because the expectation for him to keep up his body from the Untitled video was unprecedented, and he some nights would cancel a show because he literally just didn't want to go on stage and he didn't want to face that he didn't look like that some nights. He was very insecure and he couldn't handle the eyes, the new eyes that were being put on him. After this tour, he took a very long break of 13, 14 years. The record was riddled with countless delays, mostly due to the folding of EMI Records, which is the label that D'Angelo was originally signed to, and the album was scheduled for release on November 23rd, 1999, but it was pushed back 2 months to the new year. So thank God for that, because at least it made the cutoff to make the Planet 2000s podcast. In an interview with Entertainment Weekly in 2000, Questlove said, "We knew this album would be a hard pill to swallow. Many people wanted D'Angelo to play into their R&B love god fantasies, wearing Armani suits, singing something sweet to your ear, but he made a conscious effort to shake people up, to take a chance. It's not a middle ground record. You're either going to love it or you're going to hate it. And when Devil's Pie and Left and Right actually failed to make a real impact on the Billboard charts, Virgin Records got really nervous and they weren't sure what to do in order to make the album a success and to make sure that it sells. And the label, for example, had a plan for the world premiere of the Left and Right video. And MTV execs had planned promos and a world premiere for the video, but the video exceeded Virgin Records' budget and resulted in them actually missing the deadline for the MTV premiere. And MTV never put the final edit of the clip in rotation as payback, and it only got played on BET, so we had that sabotage there. And D'Angelo was everywhere promoting the album. The Chris Rock Show, countless radio concert shows, in-store appearances at Macy's, Virgin Megastores in New York City's Fulton Mall, the MTV Movie Awards, the MTV VMAs, and finally, the Untitled video was released, and it was all the promo that they ever needed. In January 2000, a press release for the Voodoo album was issued discussing the album's experimental edge and the anticipation for its release, and it called Voodoo the CD that D'Angelo was put on this earth to make, and quite literally the record that much of the Universal Soul Nation has been fiending for. They were right, they were not exaggerating. In its first week, Voodoo debuted at number 1 on the Billboard 200, selling 320,000 copies in its first week, and it remained on the chart for 33 consecutive weeks, replacing Carlos Santana's Supernatural from the top spot on the chart dated February 12, 2000. It also reached number 7 in Canada, number 9 in Norway, number 10 in New Zealand, 13 in Sweden, and 21 in the UK. It went platinum in the US, gold in the UK and Canada, and Time Magazine called it the number 1 album of the year 2000. He also won a Grammy Award for Best R&B Album, and it is on the list of Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Albums of All Time at number 28. So, the moment we've been waiting for, the deep conversation about every song on the record. You guys, this is a class on music education, okay? This is pure R&B, neo-soul jazz. Alex and I talk about it, and I can't wait for you guys to hear our conversation. So let's take it away. Now joined, as promised, by my friend Alex. So a little background on him. We work together, but he's also quite the music nerd, kind of like me, and he's about to school me on this episode. So Alex, welcome to Planet 2000s.
It's finally happening. Yeah, we've been circling each other to do this for a while and just waiting for our Venn diagram of music interest to cross, and I think we found the good one. I don't know if I'm going to be able to school you on it, because the more and more I read into this, the more I realized there's just an insane amount of musical history and music theory that goes into it, but I think we're gonna do our best and try and give context to the album.
Just before we start, like, just let people know, A, like, how we know each other, but B, like, how you got into this album, but also just music in general, what you usually lean towards and whatnot.
Yeah, Michael and I work closely together. I think we're actually taking a break right now from preparing Oscars. My music interests, I remember just like from a young age, I was drawn to hip hop, R&B, soul for whatever reason. Like my first musical memory is watching Mace and Puff Daddy's Feel So Good music video. And I was just like, this is cool. Like, I don't know if you remember that one.
Of course.
They're dancing. Yeah, of course you do. So from there, I grew up in like the Napster, LimeWire age, and I was just like a nerd downloading music, meticulously uploading it. I'm a little OCD, as you can attest to, and just like trying to go back and listen to as much as I could, getting into hip-hop, Tribe Called Quest, Tupac, Biggie, De La Soul, and I didn't really even realize that I was like circling all of D'Angelo's collaborators up to this point, and I got into his music a little later, and man, it's good.
Like you said, this is kind of where our tastes intertwine a little bit, because I think, I mean, obviously, if you're listening to this, you know that I love my pop music, but I also have, I love R&B and soul and whatnot. And so a lot of the artists that I loved growing up, like Mariah Carey, would always intertwine that in their music. And so that's kind of how I got my like younger education on older hip hop and R&B artists and things like that, because they would always collaborate with her. Just like you, as I got older, I got a little bit deeper into everything in that world. And so, and then here we are today. D'Angelo, this album is quite the, it's like almost like a schooling on soul and of the early 90s, 80s, 70s, because he really incorporates all of those funky sounds into what would be like one of the first R&B albums of the new millennium, right? So he was kind of ushering in that older sound. And also, like, if you were a fan of him from his first album, this one was so much less mainstream, which is funny, because if you think about it, in terms of like actual wide appeal. This album probably made him more of a star, but its sound is not mainstream at all. And that's something that always amazed me about why, like, this album, because it managed to kind of break into that mainstream market while not being mainstream at all. But that just goes to show, when something's really just good, majority of people are gonna flock to it. Yeah. And I know you've seen him live before, right?
Yeah, I saw him at Bonnaroo in 2015. So that was after the album he dropped in 2014, which was, you know, as you mentioned, it came out in 2000, and it came out in January 2000. So we're really just squeezing it into your podcast timeline here. But
yeah,
yeah, like it was 14 years between those two albums. There was 5 years between Brown Sugar and this album. And like you said, like, the fact that he is as legendary as he is, like, the music speaks for itself. It transcends like what was popular at the time, the amount of time that he took in between, especially today. Like, it's quantity over quality. And like, if you don't put out a track every like month, it's like you're forgotten. But this album is so good, despite not being like mainstream at all. In fact, he was like actively fighting against like the sounds of that time.
Yeah.
And when I saw him at Bonnaroo in 2015, and it's one of my, Bonnaroo, for those who don't know, is a music festival in Tennessee. It was one of my favorite shows I've ever seen. It's a little hazy. you know, it was enhanced for sure, but like, I love live instrumentation, and it felt like you were at like one long jam session.
Yeah.
And I think that that's like perfectly reflective of this album, because it was recorded live, and like, he incorporated like so many people into this record, so many instruments. And like, I don't think if he ever played any of these songs, you'd hear the same thing twice. And I think that's what makes this album so special too.
I think How Does It Feel is the only song that wasn't done with live instruments. Every other song was done different from the first one, right? Like, they don't have, these songs are less conventional, I would say, in structure. Because I've been re-listening to this album preparing for this, and I'm like, I've known a lot of these songs for the better of 10 to 15 years at this point. Some I've known since they came out, like the singles, but the other ones I learned more when I was like 2010 or whatnot. And I'm like, hey, I've still known these songs for 15 years, but I still don't really know the words to everything, because I'm hearing something new every single time that I listen to it, which is awesome. And most of the songs are like 7 minutes long, because there's literally jam session breaks in between. But I mean, we may as well just get right into it. There's 13 songs. The first one is Playa Playa. It's a opening moment. He has a lot of cool metaphors in the lyrics, but it's, I think, a great indication of the sound and the journey we're about to go on in this album, because it is a slow funk and jazz vibe and has a lot of bass in the song. Even just like the lyrics of the song, I've always loved, because he's kind of like dissing the other neo-soul guys, because he came out, what, in 95? And then after he came out, all of a sudden we had like Maxwell, Cam, and all these different artists.
Erykah Badu.
Yeah, Erykah Badu. Even Lauryn Hill, you know, like, that weren't mimicking the sound, but it's like he kind of was the first. So he's just like, in this song, it's almost like he's reminding people. He's like, okay, I see you guys, but I'm the one.
And also, I found out, this was like just connecting my childhood in every way, that he wrote this song when he was doing the soundtrack for Space Jam. So, you know, the song is called Playa Playa. The like metaphors that you mentioned, it's all basketball related. And, you know, that was cool for me. But I just want to like really emphasize how much of a prodigy D'Angelo was. Like you said, like, when it came to neo soul, this was like the exact opposite of what was popular at the time. One of my favorite albums ever, because as you remember, like, from the time when we were kids, like, when you had a CD, you listened to that shit until it like, till it was done, like, till it was filled with scratches. And one of the CDs that I had growing up was Blackstreet, Another Level.
Yeah.
Most people might know that as the album with No Diggity, but like, I think I know every word to that song, and like, it's fun. And it's like very emblematic of what 90s R&B is at that time. Mm-hmm. Very modern, like, all those beats were made like in the studio, but this is real music. And not to sound like an old head, like, both are good, and I think I go to like either one at different times, but D'Angelo played every instrument, like, not on this record, but just in general. Like, he knew how to do everything. Like, Brown Sugar, he did all his own vocal tracks. He played everything. He produced everything. So it's like, those are the artists that the work stands on its own, you know, and why it lasts so many years. And even his manager at the time, I think, coined the term neo soul, and it was like based on that movement that was happening at the time with those other artists you mentioned. But D'Angelo was like a huge part of that.
Oh, absolutely. That manager of his, Dominique, she like really was the helm of like making him a real star, because she, it was her idea to do the whole Untitled Naked thing as well. But we'll get to that in a bit. But
I'll get to that.
I love what you said. I actually didn't know that this was for the Space Jam soundtrack, but it makes perfect sense. I wonder why it didn't end up on that soundtrack. I mean, I know that he kind of took a little bit of a break in between, and maybe he just didn't want to do the whole corporate America thing with this.
Yeah, he was doing a lot of soundtrack stuff at that time. And, you know, as you know, he took 5 years off in between. Like, he was a very reclusive artist. And like, I'm not going to pretend to know what he was thinking, but whatever he did, like, turned to gold, you know.
Well, this song it would have fit perfectly, but I guess I kind of like it even better as an opening track to this album, because it almost is like a point into this new version of him as an artist. Although with this song being after like an I Believe I Can Fly, probably would have been sick on that soundtrack, but it's all good. I'll take it as the opener.
I also think that he was in the mode of like, because he was so particular about like what he put on his album. Yeah. Like there's to me, it would make sense if he wanted to like hold this for himself, because we'll get into this too with later songs on the album, but there were like, he was so particular about who he had on the songs. Like, he was taking beats from other artists because he's like, I need that. So like, it could have been a instance where he was just like, I'm not giving it, this is a Space Jam. Yeah. Like, I'm keeping this for myself.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess it makes sense, right? Because he is kind of like, not necessarily dissing the other neo soul artists, but insinuating that I am the greatest here. So it does fit better as an album of hits.
He's in his bag.
Yeah, he's in his bag. I mean, even like, it sounds a little Stevie Wonder-ish a little bit in the chorus. So that's kind of where when I listened to this, I was like, oh, I hear like 70s, like Stevie Wonder in terms of like the instrumentals, like songs in the key vibe, I think.
The bass on this song and the drums, like, you know, we'll talk about this too, but Questlove was like heavily involved in this album, and like, you know, J Dilla inspired or influenced like drum patterns, which are just like a little bit off. Like, they sound like dirty. Yeah. And like, that was very intentional. And just like those elements of the tracks and the whole album are like almost as integral as like his singing, which is like also on another level, which again is like what makes this legendary.
D'Angelo was a member of the Soulquarians, I think it was, the collective with all of those
artists.
With Love included, J Dilla. I think Erykah Badu is in there, Mos Def and whatnot. Well, moving on to the next song, because speaking of Soulquarians, Devil's Pie. So, fun fact about this song is Questlove, he said that the song was written because Questlove was by D'Angelo's side through every single song on this album. Every single song, every session, he was there. He said that it was written to address the issues of kind of like the money hungry state that they were in. And he called it the jiggified state as a reference to Jay-Z, because Jay-Z was just popping off at that time. And he said that the world of hip hop and whatnot was kind of turning into this money hungry world, and it wasn't so much about the message. For like, kind of like Tupac's music was always about the message and bringing importance to what was going on and awareness, whereas I guess when the Jay-Z era, I'll call it the Jay-Z era just simply in reference
that's
to
fair
comment, but the Jay-Z era was kind of like shifting to a more like money hungry world. So then the song Devil's Pie, which was written for the movie Belly, which for those of you guys who don't know, it's such a good movie. T-Boz from TLC is in it, so obviously that's my brand. But Devil's was the song from that soundtrack. It was the first song he released from this album as well. And it talks about that. It's still a funk song, but it has a little bit of a hip-hop groove. He performed this at the MTV Movie Awards as well. So it was the first single. It wasn't like a huge hit or anything, but it was almost like the intro, because he released this at the end of 98 to go with the movie, but he was still working on the album at the same time. And we didn't get another single for like another year, but yet he continued to perform it. And I think this is one of the more recognizable songs from the album in terms of just like what people who maybe, if you don't listen to the whole album, you might know this song.
This is definitely one of my favorite songs, and yeah, I do think it's one of the more palatable for like your average music listener. No shots fired at anyone, but like, this is you know, a little bit more traditional. You mentioned like the hip hop production on this, like DJ Premier is a producer on this, and you can like hear the scratches and the samples. And like, I went through a Gangstar phase, and like DJ Premier is one of the most legendary producers ever. And it's such a signature style. And you feel that in this song.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's thick. And like you talked about taking down, or at least commenting on, the materialism that was kind of going on in hip hop. I think that just like goes overall with like, with the theme of D'Angelo trying to like go back to like the root. And reading about this, he was truly like a music nerd, a music historian. And, you know, he was saying like R&B at that time wasn't R&B anymore. It was pop. And it sounds like, you know, there was that idea of hip hop kind of getting to a place that was away from where originally was as well. I actually didn't even realize until I started reading up more about D'Angelo for this, is that like he started out rapping as well in the early 90s. And there's some songs where you can kind of hear that. So I would love for D'Angelo to drop the rap record, you know?
I feel like it's probably ready. Knowing him, he probably has like 20 albums in his vault, and he's just not releasing it simply because he just doesn't want to be out in the limelight. But I do hear he's going to be putting out some new music soon.
So. I was just going to ask, do you think he's going to put out a new album again?
I do, because Black Messiah came out, 14 years after Voodoo. So, hey, it's only been 10 years since then. So let's give it another 4 and then see.
Yeah, he's right on track. He's right on track with the timeline. He's released 3 albums in like 30 years. So there you go.
Yeah, I mean, he did the verses, which like by himself. And I think that was supposed to be against Maxwell, and they didn't end up doing that. But he still did it by himself and brought out everybody. So, I mean, I don't think it's over for him. I definitely think he's working on music.
In Michael's words, iconic.
Those are Michael's words. Anyone who listens to this podcast knows that I repeat the same phrases, and iconic is one of them. But that's what this is. And wait, speaking of iconic, because I have to always bring in the pop connection here. DJ Premier, how did I learn who DJ Premier was in my life? Because obviously as a kid, listening to songs that I knew on this album were like, I knew Send It On, I knew Untitled, and I knew Devil's Pie, and I knew Left and Right. But I didn't like have the album or anything, so I didn't know who worked on it. But I was a huge fan of a lady named Christina Aguilera, and on her album, yes, Back to Basics, it's a 2-disc album. That first disc is all produced by DJ Premier, all of it. And so I knew who DJ Premier was from the time I was 10 years old, because he did, so you know, Ain't No Other Man by Christina Aguilera was produced by DJ Premier, and a whole bunch of other songs on that album. And they have that, all those samples, all that scratchy tones, but he made it pop. Yeah. So I find it funny that this is just me being annoying, but I find it funny that the producer who worked on a song like this, which is all about not, I don't want to say selling out, but let's just say selling out because it's pop, and then 5 years later worked on a Christina Aguilera album. So just a note, a little bit of an irony moment.
You got to get the bag, man. Just chase the bag.
Got to get the bag. But
DJ Premier solidified his status, and then you just, you know, it's the natural progression. And Christina Aguilera earned a little street cred in my books for that. I had no idea.
Yeah, listen to that album, that first, it's the first disc, so it's the first 13 songs on the Back to Basics album. Every single one is produced by DJ Premier. There might be like one or two that weren't, and if you listen to it, you'll be able to hear it. And now that I told you that, re-listen to songs like Ain't No Other Man, you'll be like, okay, I kind of hear that. And she's also, fun fact, a huge study, like she loves neo-soul. So Jill Scott, all of those artists are her biggest influences, actually. So it makes sense why she would go to a producer like a DJ Premier for that album. But yeah, no, Devil's Pie. It has 14 million streams almost on Spotify. So for a song that's like not a new song and wasn't necessarily a hit, that actually does stand out, because the average streams for a song like that would be like 2-3 million. So there are people who are still listening to this and who are still discovering it. Great, great song. And watch that MTV Movie Award performance if you haven't, because personally, he just looks really good in that.
We're still just dancing around it. We're gonna get to it soon.
Yeah, I know. Well, hey, the next track, Left and Right, featuring Method Man and Red Man, is basically all in that realm. It's literally a sex song. I mean, it's a groovy sex song, but that's what it is.
Literally.
I love it because it's one of the more up-tempo song. It's like a funky party jam, I would say, but it's not too annoying. Like, you could dance to it, but you can still vibe to it. I love the line. There's a line about TLC's No Scrubs that I think it was Red Man who does that line in the song. And I was like, oh, this is just my brand. This is just so good. I don't know. I've always loved this song. I've known it since I was a kid because they used to play this video on Much Vibe all the time.
This is like definitely the one I think that is the most, well, other than Untitled, The one that people would know the most, and like no coincidence, it has Method and Red on it. That's like a year after their album Blackouts. This is like at the peak of their popularity at that time. And I love this song too. And then as I read more about it, I started to have not conflicted feelings, but you started to hear more about how maybe Questlove and D'Angelo ended up not loving this song as much. Like Method and Redman's verses are kind of in that braggadocious rapper vein and maybe a little misogyny in there.
But this song also had a journey just from its inception, because it wasn't even supposed to have Method Man and Redman. It was originally going to have Q-Tip on it, and they hated his verse. Actually, I think it was his manager, Dominique, who said that she thought that Tip's verse was whack. So they
How is that possible?
That's what I'm saying. Like, does Q-Tip even know how to make a whack verse? Like, I think I need to hear that version. Not that I don't love Method Man and Redman on the song, because I actually do love their vibe on it. And they've since performed, like, they came out during his verses, and they had their vibe. And I love Method Man and Redman together, personally. But I am curious what Q-Tip's verse would have been like. Maybe it would have been a little bit more, maybe a little less misogynistic. How about that?
Yeah, we need that leak. But also, I have a question for you, and I don't know if you want to age yourself, but what year were you born in?
1995.
Okay, so I had a theory. D'Angelo's son's name is Michael, who was born in 1997. This song came out in 1999, and given the theme of the song, I thought maybe, I don't know, maybe Michael was conceived during this song, and it just would have worked out. It would have worked out too perfectly, but...
I know, I wish. Not quite. I was already on this earth, but I was probably conceived when the first album came out.
Your parents were being... they were just bumping Brown Sugar?
I don't know about that. They weren't really into the R&B. My aunt was. I actually got a lot of my R&B love as a kid from my aunt, because she's the one who listened to all these artists. My parents were more like I knew Shania Twain from my parents, not R&B. That was my aunt who showed me all of this stuff, for sure. But
also featured on Planet 2000's Shania Twain. So 100%. Listeners, go back and check that out.
Oh yeah, it literally just came out with that one. And I also love the video for this song too, because there's obviously like the scenes where he's just there, like shirtless, and he had just done his all workout plan and kind of changed up his whole body. But it's also interwoven with scenes in like what looks like a 70s, like psychedelic club vibe. I mean, I definitely got that vibe from this, and I feel like it kind of matches the sound as well of the song. So it's just a good vibe. So yeah, Much Vibe. For my reference to Much Vibe earlier, for you guys who don't know, because in Canada, Much Music is MTV, the equivalent. And they used to play all their R&B videos that weren't necessarily the pop R&B, would always be played in like this 2 hour or 1 hour block called Much Vibe that I would always watch at like 11 p.m. And so this was a big hit on that one. Moving on to track number 4, The Line. Upon like re-listening and actually paying attention to the lyrics for this one, I feel like it's more introspective. It's definitely like a slower song. It's down tempo. I feel like he's actually digging deeper. And there's a critic who said that it might be about him, his MIA status, because there's a lyric in there that goes, will I hang or get left hanging? Will I fall off or is it banging? I say it's up to God. So a lot of people who were reviewing the album at that time were like, well, he's been gone for so long, so maybe this is him like with his dilemma, like, do I stay? Do I go? Do I leave this industry? I'll leave it up to God. And obviously God said, no, you're coming back with an iconic album. Iconic times two, second time I've said it. And I kind of get that vibe too. And there's a lyric like, he's going to hold on to his pride. He's going to stick to his guns. I'm going to hold on to my pride, like that vibe. So it fits with everything that we've been reading about him and him in that time. Like, do I want to continue in this industry? I feel a lot of R&B artists get that way, because maybe that just that genre is so introspective, and it's so much work in the studio, and then you're putting your soul, your heart and soul into it, for lack of a better term, soul.
For sure. Yeah, it's 5 years. This album comes after Brown Sugar, and like he kind of disappeared off the face of the earth a little bit. People were clamoring for more, and I think this song addresses that absence, addresses the pressures that he felt. Like he even writes in the songs, like personal and political pressures, being under the microscope. But I don't know, like one, this is another thing, and you know, not to be too cliche, but like another hallmark of great music is when it's just like the relatability. When obviously I cannot relate to what D'Angelo went through in the mid to late 90s, but the message about like perseverance and like, and if I can hold on, I'm sure everything will be all right. I don't know, man. I just felt this track. And Questlove also was saying like, about the song. Like, it tells me that no matter how confident we seem, there's always a tinge of doubt lurking in the background. And I feel like that's kind of like the D'Angelo experience. And we'll talk again more. He took another massive break after this album, and it was just that perfectionism, kind of had that tortured artist syndrome. I love how honest he gets on this track.
Well, it's about dealing with some type of adversity. Like, he doesn't get too specific with it, but I mean, anyone who's just a little bit familiar with his situation and whatnot can kind of deduce. It's like the price of fame. You're the price of your anonymity. At this point, he got really famous off that first album. There were top 10 singles. It did very well. He won awards. And so it was different for him, especially because he is a true artist. So a lot of the time, true artists, they shine more when they're just playing music. It's not so much the notoriety or the fame that they want. I mean, obviously, any artist wants to get their music out there to as many people as possible, but I don't think they always realize what will come with that. And so I think he is definitely a tortured artist. This song is an epitome of that. I feel like a lot of the songs on Black Messiah kind of coincide with a song like this, The Line. It's definitely not a song that's like a lighter listen if you pay attention. If you just play it in the background, I think that you can definitely groove to it just like the other songs on the album. But when you're actually paying attention, you're like, oh, this one is hitting a little deeper.
I've listened to some of your past episodes, and like, it's funny that we're like pulling out like quotes from like D'Angelo and Questlove, but again, like, I feel like this is like, thank God for Questlove, by the way, because he's talked a lot about this record, and as we've talked about, D'Angelo kind of likes to let the art speak for itself, but like, this is really like, I feel like you could write a thesis on this album, you know? And we haven't even really touched on, and like, partly because like, you know, I don't want to talk out of my ass, but like, all of the influences with like the album, like from like Prince to like Miles Davis and James Brown, and like, there's so much here. So I do think it's important to kind of like highlight some of these, what they're saying about the project, because like, it really requires some like inspection. Like, I highly advise anyone who's like a fan of this album to do some reading on it, because I think that this album kind of like, I consider myself like pretty knowledgeable about music, for especially for like hip hop in the eras that I really enjoy, but this kind of like exposed a blind spot for me. Like, as someone who loves hip hop and soul and R&B, it's like, I have not given enough listens to like the Stevie Wonders and the Princes of the world.
Seeing where he recorded this album, it was recorded at Electric Lady Studios in New York, which is Jimi Hendrix's studio. So already you're surrounded by so much history when you're creating the music, that naturally every other influence of his was like Prince, like Stevie, like Jimi Hendrix, was going to come out in his sound. And you touched on this earlier, but this kind of leads us into the next song. He just became a father in this time, right? Like, he had his son, Michael, and then in 99, he had his daughter. And so that was all before the album even came out. Now we're leading into a song, track 5, Send It On, which was actually, out of all of these songs that are on this album, I mean, he had been in the studio for a couple years before playing around and whatnot. I know he released a jazz live album, but from the tracks that we hear on this album, the first song he made was Send It On, and it was the birth of his son that inspired him to write that song. And this song was done at a recording studio in Virginia, back in his hometown. So this one wasn't done at Electric Lady Studios, the rest were. That's when he kind of felt the artistic vibe coming right out of him, like opening up that vault almost. And it was written with his former girlfriend and I guess baby mama. I don't want to call her a baby mama, but that's whatever. Like, mother of his children at that time, or still, sorry. And she's known. Yeah. and the lyrics of this song are so, you know, there's themes of honesty, faith, and love. And I'm a huge sucker for a trumpet. That's why I love neo-soul music so much, versus, not that I obviously love R&B, but I consider R&B a little bit more on the pop vibe, where neo-soul is more authentic to me in what R&B is. And the trumpets in this song are just like, woo. This song, I think, Send It On, has so many layers to it, because it can be played in so many different instances. It can be a love song, like it could be like a lovemaking song, but it could also just be like a relaxing song. It could be an introspective song, because again, he's talking about honesty and he's talking about his faith and love. I mean, he was feeling the biggest love of his life at this time. He just had a baby and he was with the woman that he loved. And I think this is one of the biggest songs, bigger songs on the album, at least in terms of streams. This one has 27.3 million, so it's definitely lasted a lot longer versus the other ones. I have to say, I'm a sucker for a song about someone becoming a mother or a father. I don't know why. I don't know what it is, but there's just that authenticity, I should say, to it, and vulnerability. Not that his music isn't always vulnerable, but this song especially, his vulnerability in his vocals and the delivery, it's like butter to me. Send It On, a classic.
Yep. Yeah, I think it's like interesting to me. I didn't know that it was like one of the most streamed songs, and it's like
It is. Yeah,
it kind of speaks to just like the power of the music, because it's not like overly traditional, and like you said, like I love how it can be interpreted in multiple ways. Like it is a love letter to his son. It's also could be interpreted as towards like his partner at that time, and in like faith, spirituality, communication, and like those are things that. I think if I would have listened to this song 10, 20 years ago, well, 20 years ago, I would have been way too, this would have gone right over my head.
Yeah.
But like at the time in my life where I'm at now, like this one like really resonated with me, like unexpectedly, even if it take forever and a day for me to do, I got to send it on to you. Mm-hmm. I felt that it's just a sweet song. This was the song that kind of like started the process of this album. And I think D'Angelo said in taking a break in between the two albums, like he had writer's block and he's like, you got to like live life to have inspiration to write from. Right. And I think having his son and exploring that part of his life and fatherhood and everything else he was going through from a fame perspective really like shaped this track and then just carried on throughout the whole record.
You say you relate to this, so this is a song about fatherhood. Is that on the road for you, Alex? You're telling me right now.
I mean, you know what? I didn't want to get too personal. I was trying to leave it vague, but yeah, fatherhood is definitely something that I would love in my life. I think it was bracing more spirituality in my life, having more faith and wanting to become a better communicator. Like I was, like I said, like when he's talking about like struggling with all that stuff, it was just like, damn. It's like another example of how like it's relatable with like, it's broad enough to be relatable, but specific enough that I'm sure it felt very true to him.
And the people who influenced him would do in their music. They did the same thing. And all of Prince's songs were written by him. So, you know, so many elements of who he is or was, I should say, were in his songs, but you know, a lot of the time you leave them vague enough so that people can make their own attributes to it with their own experiences. And
that's why they're the goats.
Yeah, that's why they're the goats. Send It On as one of those. Speaking of Prince, the next track, Chicken Grease. This song, to me, you hear Prince all over it. Like I thought that from the minute I heard it. And then when I was digging into the history of this song, I learned that chicken grease is an actual term that Prince used to use. So I'm reading a definition here. It's a technical term that Prince used for his guitarist to play a ninth minor chord while playing 16th notes. And
you didn't know that?
I didn't know that. No, I literally learned that while I had no idea.
Wake up.
I know. I told you guys he was going to school me, but like, it's fine. I schooled myself on this while doing my research. Okay, baby. But it's a fun song, right? And the lyrics are, they advise against like acting uptight, right? Like being like, just like loosen up a little bit, have some fun. I know you got soul. There's a line that he references. That's an actual Eric B. and Rakim song from 87. And he references that in the song. It has a great harmony, a great bass. What I learned also is that this song was actually written for Common for his album Like Water for Chocolate, but instead D'Angelo offered Common song Get to Heaven Part 2 so that he could keep this. So I guess he was writing the song with Common in mind, and just like he did with Playa Playa, I was like, fuck this, I'm keeping it for myself. And then it gave him a different song. But it's such a, I love this song. This song is definitely one of my like groovier favorites on this album. It's a good cooking song too, with a nice glass of wine. Fun fact, you guys listening, just so you know.
Use that Crisco. No, like he's definitely talking his shit on this. Like he's feeling himself a little bit. This is like a good example. Like you said, like the name of the song is like a tribute to Prince. It sounds like Prince, and like this is one of those songs that it was like mind-blowing for me to figure out how many influences that D'Angelo was like cramming into this, into the music. And yeah. I found a quote of him saying online, like, I consider myself very respectful of the masters who came before. In some ways, I feel a responsibility to continue and take the cue from what they were doing musically and vibe on it.
Yeah.
That's what I want to do, but I want to do it for this time in this generation. And like, that's why this record was as like significant as it was, because he did take the sound of his, like, the forefathers, for lack of a better word, and he, like, put a modern twist on it. Like, he was using proper instrumentation, but mixing it with, like, these modern hip-hop beats. And, yeah, Chicken Grease just goes crazy. Like, I think this is one of, in the depths of my brain, I have a vague recollection of hearing this one live, and I was watching it on YouTube before this, and it's just, like, the whole band going crazy, the interludes, this is definitely a standout from the album.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, this one probably hits so hard live, especially because, like, you hear so many background voices in the song, so it almost is just like he's literally playing it at a jam session or at a bar with everyone around him jamming out. And so I was like, oh, this would go really hard at a festival. When I was re-listening to this, I was like, yeah, this is on my bucket list. I need to hear this one live for sure.
You had to be there.
You had to be there. You had to be there. This song, I actually remember. I listened to the album when I was younger, like 15, 16, but a lot of the songs, like, I had forgotten. And over COVID, I had bought the vinyl to this because I was listening to, like, an Apple Music playlist that was done by Alicia Keys, and this song was on it. And then I played it and I was like, oh, fuck, I need to buy this album on vinyl. So this is actually the song that inspired my vinyl purchase for the Voodoo album and me actually getting back into D'Angelo's music besides for the singles. So we love Chicken Grease for that reason as well.
I also have a vinyl addiction.
Oh, yeah?
I've been listening to this album a lot over the last week, and I've already have plans to go on a walk later, which is just an excuse to go to the record store near me and see if I can find this album.
I have the version that's a white vinyl, so every time I pull it out now, everyone who's like home, because I always play this when I'm cooking. So if I'm cooking for my roommate or my neighbor who always comes over, I do play this, and they always are just like, what a pretty vinyl. I'm like, yep, thank you, one of my favorite purchases.
The vinyl traditionalists are shaking right now with the white vinyl.
Well, no. What are we supposed to do? This album came out in 2000. There was no vinyl release. I mean, they probably did.
You were five.
I was five, so I couldn't have bought it. But also, vinyls weren't being made back then. They were only being made to send to like DJs and stuff. So yes, everything that's come out after 1992 has to be repressed, you fuckers. So get over it.
Yeah, and this has become like one of those, if you know, you know, vinyls. Like, it's had a complete like second life. This is like what the crate diggers are looking for. Although I'm sure there's millions of copies being pressed right now, so the record companies can continue to make money off of it. This is a good one to have. I'm going to have to add it to my collection.
I give them all my money, so I'm a sucker. They find suckers.
Yeah, you and me both.
Yeah, and then they reel me in. Track 7, One Mo' Gin. I mean, to be honest, I think this is kind of like a track that speaks for itself. I mean, it's literally him reminiscing about a former lover and him just wanting to have another round with her. One Mo' Gin is kind of like, it's supposed to mean like one more time. Mariah Carey has a song called One Mo' Gin as well, just by the
really?
Way. She sure does.
Iconic.
Yes. but yeah, the song I think is classic D'Angelo. When you think of what a D'Angelo song would sound like, I would put One Mo' Gin in there. It has that soft organ and percussion that is in all majority of his songs. Very, very strong jazz overtones, I would say. Questlove's drum rhythm is like insane on this song. I think it's also like a signature Questlove sound. It's a sexy song, I think. As much as it's like, it's him reminiscing about a lover and things like that. Like, I don't know. I think it's a sexy song. It's kind of like old school, new school meets old school soul.
A classic D'Angelo track. Like, I don't even have many thoughts. I know I wrote down Smooth as Fuck.
Yep.
I wrote Fire Funk Interlude at the end of the song, which just like speaks to that, like, live jam session vibe that the whole record's got going on. But from like a content standpoint, like you said, this is such a simple concept. It's like, oh, you see an ex and you're what, like, you've been thinking about her and wondering what's going on with her, and I just want to like kiss you again. And not to get too personal again, but I was like, damn, like, I was listening to the song and I was just having my feels for a little bit. And I for the whole album, like, I feel like this is like, you have to have a candle burning when you listen to this album.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Sandalwood for me.
Yeah, I'm burning woods right now. Sydney Hale Company. I'm available for sponsorship. I just gave you guys a shout out.
You know what? You got Sydney Vale. Please hit up Plant at Planet2000s on Instagram, I'll give you a good deal. But like, yeah.
The official candle of Planet2000s.
I'm here for that. This next part of the album, I would say, like from One Mogan onward, we get into a little bit of like a heartbreak era in the songs, because the next song, The Root, also, it's a mid-tempo heartbreak song. I mean, there's a lyric in there that she left a dirty stain in my heart that I can't refute. So it's really like this woman's effect on him in a negative way. Kind of like, there's another lyric in there. In the name of love and hope, she took my shield and sword. From the pit of the bottom that knows no floor, like the rain to the dirt, from the vine to the wine, from the alpha of creation to the end of all time. Jesus Christ. Like, I'm like, what is, she broke his heart. Someone broke his heart. Someone got him really, really, really upset in his feels with this one.
I have the thought that came to mind when I was listening to this in more modern language is he's down bad. I think like I was laughing because one of the quotes he had is like, it was therapeutic for me to do this song. It kind of helped me get over it because I'm so pathetic in this song. And I was like, hey, you said it, not me. We might have all been thinking it, but hey, but we've all been there. And
oh, yes.
We have.
I definitely have.
Say no more.
Yeah.
There's like super sick, like psychedelic type like guitar on this. Just like another example of like how many sounds he's pulling from. And I agree, like this is the point in the record where it's starting to get like less and less. Not that it's been commercial at all up to this point, but yes. It's definitely just like really musical, for lack of a better term, at this point.
Oh yeah. I mean, like you put a great psychedelic guitar, man. I mean, the Electric Lady Studios vibe, it's in this song. The soul of Jimi Hendrix, the ghost of Jimi Hendrix touched the musicians for this song to give us that vibe.
He said that literally. I think he said.
Did he actually?
Yeah, like when he was recording, it was like the ghosts of Jimi and other people were there blessing the record. So there you go.
I don't know. It's one of my favorites, this one, I have to say, just because maybe because I'm kind of going through, or not to get too personal, but like, I feel this song. I really do. And, yeah. And it just,
hey, I went there. You can go there.
Yeah. It just sucks. Like he even says like left my mojo in my favorite suit. So it's like, I don't have my confidence anymore. Like this girl like fucked up my confidence a little bit. And even to the great, if a guy like a D'Angelo who looks like him, who's creative like him, who's talented like him, can be so shaken by a woman like that, like, you know what? It happens to the greatest of us, okay?
It makes me feel better about my own struggles. If D'Angelo's struggling, then I have the right to struggle too.
Exactly. I love this next song, track 9, Spanish Joint.
Good.
It's just like, oh, so good. So good. It has a little bit of salsa infused in there, but it's like, it's more up tempo. It's groovy. It's funky. It has kind of like almost like a Brazilian funk vibe in some parts of the song. Like when there's a part in the middle where it kind of breaks out into a little bit of a jam. And I'm just like, okay, I can definitely hear the Spanish vibes in here. I read somewhere that a lot of the instrumentation is similar to Stevie Wonder's Don't You Worry About a Thing from 1973. So I actually went and listened to it and I was like, oh, I can definitely hear that. So you guys listening, and even Alex, if you don't know that song, listen to it back to back and you can definitely hear Stevie's influence on this. The lyrics are about karma. That's why I say it goes right perfectly to go after The Root, because it's like karma for the lady that fucked me up.
Yeah, and he's definitely getting some shots off on some people here. I just wanted to say quickly, the congas at the beginning of the track, I'm a sucker for that. Questlove is like, this, like his band went off on this, and you can tell because it's like, it's a completely different vibe. And it's like you said, that the fastest song on the album, tempo is insane. And like the band is just going off. Yeah. I also did feel kind of like attacked by this song in a way. All you do is complain about your pain and the cloud that follows you won't cease to rain. Don't look back, handle that, make it into a good thing. I have my days when I can be like a Debbie Downer and feeling sorry for myself, but it's like, on the one hand, I recognize myself in that first part of the lyric about, you know, getting caught up in my own shit. And then I also am able to take it and like, it's not necessarily, it doesn't have to be a shot at someone. It can also be like an inspirational message. Right. And that's kind of something in my life that I've been taking, like perspective is everything. Like I can, a bad, like objectively bad thing can happen and I can I can go down that road, or I can focus on what I'm learning from it, how I can grow from it. And I feel like D'Angelo is kind of tapping into that here.
Ooh, well, you can just repeat that message to me every single morning when you see me, because I feel that.
We've had some conversations. Yeah.
Yeah, we definitely have. But you're so right. Perspective is everything. And I have my share of Debbie Downer moments. Let's just say that. We all have them. And it can be really hard when you're so enthralled in your feelings to, like you said, perspective is everything, to see the other side of things.
This whole album is like D'Angelo is going through some shit for sure. Yeah. But I think overall, there's like a hopefulness to the album. He's been away. He's been struggling. Like, he's talking about, you know, relationships and fatherhood. But like, at the end of the day, like, it seems like he's in a good place when he's writing the record, or at least he's willing to fight for making the music the way he wants to make it, like fighting to be a better father. And
yeah, all done.
We love that.
Infused beat, which I, you know, nothing I love
yeah.
than a deep message on a more fun track. To move on to the next song, which is one of my favorites, but it's actually a cover, Feel Like Making Love. It's a cover of Roberta Flack's same song from 1974. Quiet Storm R&B. This, I think, is probably the most traditional R&B song, adult contemporary R&B song, I will say. Definitely a lovemaking song. Fun fact about this one is, obviously, people who know D'Angelo, if you know his music, you know he did a song with Lauryn Hill for her album called Nothing Even Matters, which is one of the best songs on Miseducation. But this song was also going to feature Lauryn Hill. So around the time that he had recorded the song for her album, they had sent tapes, because this was before everything was digital, they had sent tapes via FedEx to her, and they were going back and forth, and it was going to happen, and then it just never did. And Questlove, when he was talking about the album, God bless him, by the way, because he really gave us so many...
Thank you, Questlove.
Like, thank you so much, because we know so much about this record because of you. But he talked about how the duet failed to materialize because there were just too many middlemen. And he says that he doesn't even think Lauren and D'Angelo ever talked face to face. And so that's why that fell out. But this would have been a duet with Lauryn Hill, which I think would have definitely elevated the track. But he still did amazingly on his own. I think it's a great cover. Like, I actually didn't even know it was a cover for a very long time. I didn't really know.
Guilty as well.
Well,
sorry. I don't know how many boomers are listening to Planet 2000s, but if you are, we're sorry. We were born in the 90s. But yeah, like, I went back and listened to the original song.
Yeah.
I must give flowers for that. Like, it's a great song, but I love to hear, like, I love a cover that's not just a straight up cover. Like, and D'Angelo does like a lot of covers. Like, yeah. He had one on his first album, The Name's Evading Me, but and in between these, what was that?
It was he did Smokey Robinson's Cruisin' on the first album.
Yes. And then he did some in between these two albums. And it's like the original is like smooth and like lovey-dovey and sweet, and then he just takes it to like such a funkier, like grimier place with this. It's also like Sliding Doors moment, like huge what if to have Lauryn Hill on this track. Like, yeah. To think about the fact that we were deprived of Q-Tip and Lauryn Hill on what is already like, and I haven't like had a chance to say this yet, but like truly now one of my favorite records and like one of the best of all time. Like, we've seen it, Rolling Stone like has it on its like best list albums list of all time, and we know it won Grammys, we know it went number one, but this album's so freaking amazing. And like, it's like splitting hairs at this point, because it's like, it's already a goated album. What's a Lauryn Hill or a Q-Tip going to do? Like, went to a 10 out of 10 anyways, but
exactly,
man, that would have been nice.
It would have been great. I mean, it would have been great, but I still do love his solo version. I will say why I really do think it would have been amazing is because Roberta Flack, I mean, if anyone knows how to cover a Roberta Flack song, it's Lauryn Hill, Killing Me Softly with this song. That is a Roberta Flack cover, and she made it her own, but still kept that soul. So I'm sure it would have been amazing, but I will take what we have. Sometimes, like, things come out and happen the way that they're supposed to. And so I think this song was supposed to be just a moment for D'Angelo to have and to have a lovey-dovey moment on this album. I love a Quiet Storm rain, you know, love making song. It's very Rain by SWV, also is kind of that quiet storm 5. It's one of my...
You just hit on another blind spot of mine.
You don't know that song?
I don't know that song.
Oh, well, let me...
I haven't gone down the SWV rabbit hole.
Let me put you on. It was the same exact era. I mean, I would say that their R&B is more commercial than D'Angelo's for sure. Like, they're not so much neo-soul as they are more R&B. But that album, Rain, that it came from was called Release Some Tension, and it was in 97. And it has all, it has a lot of hip-hop influences. So there's, like Missy's on that album. So many, Biggie's on that album. Like, so many rappers are on that album. So I actually think you would really like it. So, side note, I think you should listen.
All right, yeah, I have more homework.
A classic song. It was actually released as a single. It was the final single that was released from this album. It didn't really chart anywhere, but by that point, it was kind of the end of the album era, and that usually does happen with the final singles that are released. But it is the second most streamed song on this album with 34.1 million. This is the second most streams after Untitled. So I think that maybe it's because it's a cover of a song that is already a beloved song. He definitely got some love from the public for this. For this cover,
I wonder if, I'm trying to do the quick math, but he went on tour for the Voodoo Tour in March of 2000, So a couple months after the album dropped. Yeah. And I'm not sure when he released Feel Like Making Love. So it looks like it was in April. So yeah. I don't think his tour had kind of started having some of the issues that it would go on to have. And I was wondering if that would have had any impact on the performance of the single, but I don't really think it did because the D'Angelo craze was out of control by that point anyways, which again, we're getting there.
We're about to get there, but no, you're right. And I think also it does speak to the fact that this was the last single release and it was in April, because a lot of the issues that he kind of developed from that tour was during the second leg, which was in the late summer, fall, and we didn't get any more singles. So I think that at that point he was like, I'm done. Like, I really am done. Maybe we would have gotten more singles. I wonder what do you think he could have put out? I mean, I think Playa Playa would have been a good one. I think Chicken Grease was never a single.
Yeah.
A great one for sure as well.
That would have been challenging for people, like a 7-minute jam. But so he did Devil's Pie, Left and Right, Untitled, Send It On, and Feel Like Making Love.
Yeah.
I feel like Spanish Joint, maybe.
Yeah, I see that one too. I don't know. Either way, we got what we got and I love it. The next song that I actually was replaying a lot this morning, because this is very much a Saturday morning, Sunday morning song for me with my coffee, or like my joint and my coffee, which I think D'Angelo would
No.
because he's also a stoner, just so you guys know.
He sings about that in the song.
Yeah, he does. Great day and morning, dash beauty. This song is a two-parter. I think artists like Frank Ocean, who went on to make songs like Pyramids that are kind of like two-parters, were influenced by artists like D'Angelo who would do this. So Great Day and Good in the Morning, Dash Booty is definitely a two-parter. The first part, which is Great Day in the Morning, he's reflecting on the ups and downs of life, the search for fulfillment. He's acknowledging unpredictability, recognizing that there's good and bad days, but is remaining hopeful, persistent in his pursuit of the great day in the morning. I learned this while doing research. Great day in the morning is a saying that is actually commonly used in the South, and it's usually shortened to great day. And it's similar to phrases like great heavens or good Lord. So it's supposed to say like my goodness. So what D'Angelo does is he gives like a literal definition to that phrase, a day that begins in a great way. So we took a phrase that was used a lot and gave a literal meaning to it. And yeah, feel good Sunday morning vibes. Questlove said, actually, that this song, Spanish Joint, and The Root all serve as, in quotations, the virtuoso part of the record that has more intricate technical arrangements, not as much overdubbing, and a lot more electrical and bass guitar. So it's almost like those songs are kind of like a trilogy in sound. Then we get to the second part of the song, Booty, which is, I mean, anyone would assume this is a more sensual and upbeat approach, and it shows the other great things that could happen in the morning.
we love getting this message of great day in the morning, no matter what the recommendation is to start that great day.
Yes.
I love it's a great message. I love how practical he is. He's talking about love, prayer, even showering. Like you said, smoking a joint. It's just like very practical methods to start your day off on a good foot. There you go.
Yeah.
Any booty?
No, maybe later though. Maybe I'll end my day.
Great day in the evening. I love the optimism, talking about personal growth, self-reflection, the pursuit of happiness. Like, just a nice song. And I like that you kind of pointed to Frank Ocean.
Yeah.
Because of course D'Angelo is not the first artist to have like an interlude or a two-part song. And as we know, like he's drawing from the greats that he studied, but I think this is what separates like a good from a great or even a classic album. It's like the best artists create a world that like immerses you for the entirety of the album. And like going, having these two parts of the song, like, I'm just thinking about like more modern artists, like the ones who stand out in the last like 20 years. Like, I know he's canceled, but Kanye, when he was like in his prime, Kendrick Lamar, Frank Ocean, like, it's not just that they are creating these worlds. Like we remember Good Kid, Mad City, like Kendrick Lamar. It's like, it's a day in the life in Compton. There's skits and it's just like, you're in it. Right. Mm-hmm. And then aside from just that, the storyline that they create or the world that they're plopping you into, it's like, again, what makes it a classic is like doing, not only doing that, but also like pushing the sound forward.
Yeah.
We talked about like how D'Angelo is like combining the old with the new, taking his inspirations and putting like a modern touch on it. And yeah, it makes me think of Kanye with sampling and how he was taking that to the next level. Like he's still paying homage to like the people who influenced him, but he's taking it to the next level. Frank Ocean is putting like a gazillion effects on his voice on Blonde, but it's like, you know, it's groundbreaking. And so when I listen to this album, again, not knowing enough about who his influences were, I do know that like even listening to music from his era, like this is next level shit.
Oh, absolutely. Next. And well, I mean, we'll get into it right now. Next level shit.
Mm-hmm. Here it is.
Here it is. This song. What do we like? I actually don't even know where to start talking about this song. I can tell you all that this was my sexual awakening at a very young age. It really was. Not to creep anyone out, but I was literally 5 years old realizing, oh, okay, I'm done. Because,
that's cool.
Because of this song and video. I mean, by this point, this was
my music video for that was Crazy in Love by Beyonce. So, you know, excellent. That's when I had my sexual awakening.
Excellent, excellent choice. I mean, listen, nobody was more beautiful than B in that time. So I'll give you that. this song was released on New Year's Day 2000. So it was like, we are starting this millennium as the D'Angelo millennium. It was the third single. So we had already gotten Devil's Pie and Left and Right, but the album wasn't out yet. And so as much as there was a video for Devil's Pie, it was this song that really just pushed D'Angelo to the mainstream stratosphere. I guess before we talk about all that, let's talk about like the actual song itself, like the music. The song was written and produced by D'Angelo and Rafael Sadiq. Rafael Sadiq was a part of the Soulquarians. He was working with D'Angelo on a lot of the songs in this album. He also was in Lucy Pearl at this time, who I fucking love Lucy Pearl. It's with Dawn from En Vogue, and they did a whole album together. And I've heard a lot of stories about Rafael Sadiq as a person, so we won't get into that. But as a musician, we love him. And this song, to me, and I have now gotten this confirmed by my research, but it is a tribute to Prince, 100%. Mm-hmm. As much as it does give a lot of Marvin Gaye in the vocals, but it gives a lot of Prince. And this could be a Prince song. And that was D'Angelo's Hero. It has a vintage style and it's very similar to the early pre-Purple Rain Prince, I would say. Questlove, he described it as finding the line between parody and honesty in the era of the cover song. Redoing a Prince song was taboo, and this is the second best thing. And I totally see that because, yeah, they didn't want to. Well, Prince also, not to go on too much of a tangent, but Prince doesn't like or didn't like when artists covered his songs. As much as, like, there were some amazing Prince covers, like Mariah Carey covered a Prince song, The Beautiful Ones on Butterfly, which is one of my favorites. But Prince doesn't like when people cover his songs, and D'Angelo knew that, being that Prince was his hero. So instead, they just created a song that Prince would sing, and oh, he totally, totally would have fucked this song up for sure. Like he would have killed it. But yeah, D'Angelo sounds great in this Prince vibe. I think this is definitely the signature sound.
I think Questlove also said that like this was kind of their like shooting their shot at Prince to get him on a record with D'Angelo.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I actually didn't see this in any research if Prince ever like acknowledged the song. Did you see that?
I didn't actually. No. Prince at this time also in the late 90s like post 1993 up until like God knows when, like maybe 2010, he was just like, he wasn't even Prince right at that point. I think he was still the artist formerly known as Prince because there were a lot of issues with the record labels and whatnot. So I feel like that probably also played a huge part of why he didn't really collaborate with many artists at this time, because this album, as much as it's not a mainstream record, it was on Virgin Records, like it was on a mainstream record label, and that was everything Prince was against at that time. So that must have played a huge part, but I don't actually know for a fact.
I mean, he doesn't, if Prince didn't like this, I'd be surprised. Yeah. Like, again, this is D'Angelo, like, drawing from his inspirations, but doing his own thing. And it ends like, he's just screaming, like, and then the song cuts off abruptly, which is funny because, like, the tape literally ran out to speak further to the different level of technology that they were dealing with at that time. And, like, I love that they kept it in, like, it just plays like right into the lack of perfection that the record has, but like not perfection in the sense that it's not of incredible quality. Just like the fact that it feels like you're like listening in on a studio session. And yeah, like aside from the music video, I don't know, like, well, you don't need to see the music video to like know that this is like a baby making music.
Yes.
but yeah, maybe this is the time where we get into the video.
Yeah, well, before I get into the video, I do want to touch a little bit on what you just said, the imperfection of this song, because Questlove has said, you know, because the song opens with an offbeat click on the two, and it has like a messy beat almost. It doesn't sound perfect, but that was on purpose. Like before it goes into the all, like it starts off with just like a pop, pop. It's like, okay, where are we going here? And then it ends so abruptly. So it's like it starts imperfect and it ends imperfect. But you can tell it was on purpose. And, you know, as a kid, I was always just like, why does it do that? And now I get it, because, you know, he wanted it to feel like an authentic studio session. And that's what we got. And so it's funny that they took a song like this, a 7-minute song, imperfect, not mainstream at all, and turned it into the biggest hit of his career. Definitely due to the music video, which I guess we can get into now, the Paul Hunter directed, well, co-directed, because it was also co-directed by his manager, Dominique. It was just, you know, a muscular, sexy ass D'Angelo completely fucking naked. I don't know. There's one shot.
One shot of him sweaty. he was wearing pajama pants on the bottom though, so I just wanted to dispel any like notions that you may have had that he was completely naked. call the horny police. Yeah, he was wearing pajama pants. Although they really cut it as close as they possibly could without showing everything.
Oh, they did. And in his Vibe magazine article in April 2000, Questlove, like, they played into it, okay? They knew that people thought he was naked. So Questlove asked him, is it true you were getting head in that video? And D'Angelo responded by laughing. And Questlove just said, so you're not going to answer that? And D'Angelo responded, no. They obviously knew he wasn't. He was wearing pajama pants. But they're like, okay, this shit needs to sell. And so we're going to sell this idea that I am just this sex god. And so as much as it made him uncomfortable later on in the year, it did start out like they were fully in on it. Like they knew that this was gonna be what took him to the next level. I mean, he worked out for that body for that video purposely, for God's sake. So they knew what they were doing. Paul Hunter, the director, said, we made this for the women. I say they made this for the women and the confused young gays. But I don't know if they knew that they were doing that, but that's what they were doing.
Not even just confused. he became like a sex symbol and obviously very popular amongst the gay community and with young women, and they knew exactly what they were doing. And like his manager was like, this was like an incredible job in like marketing. And I believe that his manager went on to become the president of Motown Records, which is like, you know, the tons of amazing artists come out of there, but it's obviously quite racy. And then you start to just feel for D'Angelo a little bit, because it's like, as much as someone, we've seen this happen time and time again with artists who hit like a different stratosphere of fame. It's like, and you talked about this earlier, it's like you kind of get caught in the machine and you're kind of doing what other people want you to do and what you may even think you want to do. And then it starts to get out of control and it's like a runaway train. Like you can't really stop it. And you also mentioned he was working out, like, and his trainer has said like, this is like the first time he'd ever looked like that. Like he didn't understand what it meant to become a sex symbol. And then all of a sudden he's performing. And as we know from talking about this album, like he takes the music as seriously as anyone. And then all of a sudden, people are just at a show yelling at him to take his shirt off. So he definitely struggled with that. And that was a big reason why things started to go a little south.
Yeah, well, his manager said that the music video's effect on him to this day, I mean, she did this interview in, I think, the late 2000s, and she said to this day in the general populace's memory, he's the naked dude, and that he didn't want to be the naked dude, he wanted to be a musician. And as much as the actual art itself should speak for itself, at the end of the day, when you cause that much of a media frenzy, that's what you're going to be known for. And like you said, when once you go into the stratosphere, because again, he wasn't an unknown artist, he was a very popular artist. That first album did very, very well, like people knew who he was, but this took him to another level of fame. I use Whitney Houston as a great example of that, because before she had The Bodyguard, everyone knew Whitney Houston. She had made so many records and she had all these number ones and everything, but she hadn't gone into the stratosphere. When I Will Always Love You came out and she became next level, that's when everything went downhill for her. Everything got fucked up after that, and she never recovered, obviously. I'd like to think that D'Angelo has recovered in some way from the pressures that this brought onto him. But yeah, anytime an artist goes into the stratosphere, if they're not mentally prepared or even mentally capable to handle it, it can get really, really bad for them. And, you know, for D'Angelo, yeah, it can get really bad. I mean, he ended up getting, I think he got some DUIs later on. Like, he had a rough time after this.
Yeah, he was like he had, you know, rehab and drunk driving incidents. And, you know, like, there's a world in which, like, some artists would have embraced that image. Like, you know, there's a world in which he could have been gone the Usher route. Yeah. I know that Usher is, was like a different, it's not one-to-one comparison, because Usher started really young and he wasn't going to be like overly sexualized at that young, although who knows in that era. But like, I think I remember, is it the Let It Burn video that's like super racy?
I mean, sure, but even if you go back to Nice and Slow in 1998 when Usher was 19 years old, I mean, he was singing about all that stuff. But I mean, to your Usher point, he also went to the school of Diddy when he was like 15, 14. So I don't know that he wasn't being sexualized at a very young age. We all know Diddy likes
Yeah, so like, you know, like that was like the road that he was going down. Like, you know, that's how he was being marketed. And as like we can tell from this music, he's a very introspective person. He was obviously battling, you know, some sort of, I don't want to say demons, because I don't know him like that, but he's a thoughtful guy. He's a sensitive guy. And like, that was a lot for him to handle. And it makes me think of like something else that I remember reading. It was like a quote from Questlove that I found super interesting. And like, Questlove was kind of confronting D'Angelo about, you know, his relationship with his idols. And Questlove said, they all have one thing in common. They were all vanguards, but 98% of them crashed and burned. To which D'Angelo responded, I think about that all the time. So it's almost like relating to those people who were such great artists. But as we see with a lot of like really great artists, that obsession with the craft and that the places that being that serious about it requires you to go can often be like extremely detrimental.
Well, yeah, and Questlove also has said that had D'Angelo known what the repercussions of Untitled would have been, he says, I don't think he would have done it. And I can actually agree with that. I think that if he had known that it would have been the huge, big media moment that it was, I don't think he would have gone that route. Because, you know, we talked about this earlier in the episode. This entire album was him rebelling against that commercial sound and that commercial entity and the corporate morgue, as I like to call them. It was him rebelling against that and saying, I'm not going to fucking do this. And then lo and behold, the most non-commercial, one of the more non-commercial songs on the album, like, this is an imperfect song, a 7-minute song, and then it ended up being the runaway thing that blew him up. He didn't expect that, and I don't think he would have done it. Am I glad he did it? Of course I am. This is a fucking classic, and this is one of my favorite R&B songs and videos, periods, because it also was a cultural movement. It was one of the few neo-soul songs and videos that were being played on stations like MTV, not just BET, not just in the R&B hour, not just on Much Vibe. It was being played everywhere, and it was getting treated like any pop song would have, which I love, because I love when a song that isn't as conventional breaks out, because it gives people in the general public an opportunity to hear something real. And that's always been something that I love when that happens, and it doesn't happen often.
Yeah, it's interesting to think like what things could have looked like for his career had that not happened in the way it did, because it just caused like so much insecurity. Yeah. And like, I can't imagine what it's like being someone who is just like a sexual obsession or object. Like, yeah. I think I read in an article somewhere that Questlove would be like, he would be in the dressing room or backstage before a show looking in the mirror and being like, I don't look like I did in the video. And yeah. like, they'd have to cancel a show because he, you know, just wasn't mentally fit to do it. And that, and when he was in that place. And I think like, given like the fame that he reached, like, it's hard to, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Like, would he have gotten as huge as he did without the video? Like, I think he was already probably on a collision course with like dealing with some of this stuff. So maybe he wouldn't have put out like a ton more albums had this not happened. But I do think there's a possibility that we would have more D'Angelo music if not for this.
Probably. I mean,
which is a shame because it's like, it's, you know, an incredible song, but I think it's like an early cautionary tale for, you know, something that we see happen with celebrities over and over.
Absolutely. And having said that, I mean, the song still did, you know, it gave him a lot of credibility with like the Grammys. Like, he won a Grammy for Best Male R&B Vocal Performance for this song. Rolling Stone put it at number 51 on their list of the best songs of the 2000s. And it was it reached number 25 on the Hot 100, and it was number 2 on the R&B charts. So it was a very well-performing song. He was definitely got his flowers from like the awards and all of that stuff for this. But yeah, like, it was it worth his mental health? Like, I don't think anything's worth your mental health. So no, it wasn't. But I mean, selfishly, as a music fan and music listener, I'm very happy it exists.
Yeah.
And he was my first crush, you know, my literally D'Angelo. This video is what made me like he was my first crush. And then it was Usher. But yeah, it all started with him. So thank you for that.
It's actually funny. I think I was looking on Spotify and I was surprised to see, I guess it's his third most streamed song ever. And the first is Lady. After that is Brown Sugar, which is just interesting given like, I think it speaks to like the outsized amount of attention that was paid to the, you know, public discourse around this song as opposed to like the music in general. Like, the people who listen to the music love him for that, right? But it was just this thing that got kind of blown, I don't want to say out of proportion, but blown up, that kind of defines his legacy, which is a little unfortunate, but it's a great song. And like you said, I'm grateful we have it. It's just, it was sad to read more, like read about how much it impacted had on him as I really dove into
it. It is sad. It's a, almost like you said, a cautionary tale. We'll end this album review on a more happier note, because the song Africa is the album closer. Questlove has gone on to say that Africa is actually his favorite song on the album. It was originally written in honor of D'Angelo's son, Michael. Ended up as a dedication to history, Africa, and God. I mean, there's a ton of spiritual influences on this album. Mm-hmm. It flows perfectly with everything else that he talks about. But the theme of this song, it's concerned with the finding of a spiritual home and geographical displacement and passing that sense of belonging to one's children. So teaching your children about your history and about where you come from. I mean, we'll talk about the song, but I love the way this song ends because it consists of like chopped up track snippets run backwards of all the different songs on the album. So it's like the real like conclusion to this voodoo chapter. So yes, in the lyrics, he's passing on his history to his child. So it's like that next generation. And then the actual song itself ends with all these little snippets run backwards of other songs on the album. There's a Rolling Stone article where the author says that one night that they played Prince's Parade, the song Parade, until they flowed into a new groove that became Africa. So another Prince starting moment for D'Angelo, and being influenced by Prince's music got him into writing this song.
As you mentioned, there was this song borrows a beat from a Prince song.
Yep.
I Wonder You, 1986.
Yeah.
Another thing that is, it's like a small but important thing for like a classic album is like an album's opener and a finisher.
Oh, yes.
I think Yeah. And like,
because this is, listen, you know, I listen to albums. Okay. I don't listen to singles. Yeah. I listen to albums from start to finish. I care about the sequencing of a record. I care about the story that it tells. I buy vinyls for a reason, because I love that you have to listen to it from start to finish. You cannot just, like, you can't do that whole thing. As much as I love the convenience of streaming sometimes, don't get me wrong, but there's something to be said about listening to an album from start to finish. An album like this, where it starts off away, ends away, and every song flows together, because every song on this album is sequenced so perfectly together, and they all flow into the next song. And you don't hear that anymore, except for like, so Beyoncé's Renaissance, right? Everyone was going crazy about how all the songs, like, they flowed into each other and you have to listen to it from start to finish. And I'm like, yes, you guys, why do you think she did that? Because nobody does it anymore. And the music she grew up listening to, and the music from when she was younger and when she was first starting out, like this album, that's what they did, because it was an experience that they took you on.
I agree. And like, I think it would be oversimplifying it to say that like, the first song should set the tone for the album and the last song should encapsulate the tone or the themes of the album. But, you know, like, I feel like that's kind of what happens here. Like, the first track on here is Playa Playa. It's like a 7-minute free flowing live jazz vibe type track. And it puts you in the space of like, all right, this is what I'm getting myself into. I'm going to keep listening. And then the last track is like, yeah, it's an emotional track, and I think it sums up kind of the themes that he's going for throughout the whole album, and spirituality and faith. And, you know, when I was looking, and like D'Angelo talking about the title of the album, he said, I named the album Voodoo because I was really trying to give a notion to how powerful music is and how we as artists need to respect the power of music. Voodoo is ancient African tradition. We use voodoo in the drums or whatever, the cadences, and call out to our ancestors. And that in itself will invoke spirits. So it's like, yeah, we're getting spiritual. We're getting deep. And I think that like Africa was like a really beautiful way to kind of just wrap it all up.
I can't put it better myself. Just the perfect album closer. Like every other song on this album just feels so authentic to him and what he was going through in that time, but also the music he wanted to make. So while this era may have been laden with a lot of negativity because of the impact on his mental health, when we look at this album era simply from the creation part of it, when he was in the studio creating, I'm sure it was very cathartic for him to be making all of these songs.
It was worth the wait that I wasn't waiting at that time. Not to beat a dead horse, but if we talked about what makes a classic record and like relatability and obviously message and lyricism, and I think when I think about this album as a whole, when I was younger and I listened to this album, I would have just been like, this sounds fucking sick. Like, that's all I would have been able to say is like, his voice is insane. Obviously, we get a great vibe. I'm drawn to the jazz, the soul, the funk, the blues, and everything. One of the things that's jumping out to me now that makes me want to continue to listen is like all of the messages of like spirituality and faith. And again, that's something that I just wouldn't have been able to wrap my head around before. And I think it's an album that rewards repeated listens.
It sure does. And having said that, that is the end of the Voodoo album. Before I let you go, I always ask every guest this. If someone is listening to this episode, they've never heard this album before, they've never heard any of the songs, there's three songs that you tell them you have to listen to these three songs if you don't listen to any others from this album. What are your three?
Ooh. Mm-hmm. I was not prepared for that. All right.
Put you on the spot. Mm.
So I'm trying to think, do I go with like my three favorites, or do I go with three that like show off like the range of the record?
Let's go with your three favorites.
All right. I'm going to have to do Devil's Pie. I love the production. I think it's like a perfect example of like the hip hop influence. He's got a lot to say on that. Ooh, I'm debating left and right, but you know, if I'm going to use like a sex song, I have a few to choose from. So in that slot, I'm going to go with Untitled. Okay. Like it's iconic.
Yes. Yes, it is.
I think we talked a lot about that track. So I'm going to leave it at that. And then, ooh, man, you know, I'm going to make this like a kind of like a personal choice.
Okay.
I'm going to say One Mo' Again.
Okay. I love
it. Yeah, just because I want to, if I'm like giving my two cents on the album, I want it to be, I know I have a feeling that might not be on everyone's list of like their top three from the album, but this is Alex's list. So I'm going to give that a spot.
And I think it deserves that spot. I'll do the same thing. My three, my favorite three, just like you, Devil's Pie is one of my three from this album. I love it. It's just a classic 90s R&B hip hop song. I love the message of that went behind the lyrics, but I also just love the vibe of the song, and it's just great. So I love Devil's Pie. Feel Like Making Love, that cover is one of my favorites. I've always listened to it. It's one of the few songs that I always knew. And yeah, just a favorite of mine. And I would say Untitled, but I'm actually going to give this to Send It On, because Send It On is just, I don't know, I was saying this earlier, I love a vulnerable moment, and I love a person becoming a parent and then getting to be more introspective on it. And I also just love that he wrote it with Angie Stone, who was his lover at the time. So it's very romantic and just a sweet song at the same time. So yeah, those are my three that I would say, but obviously, you know, Untitled, honorable mention for me for Chicken Grease, which is just a favorite as well.
I feel like you could like ask this question on any given day and we could both have three different songs.
Yeah, Alex, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate your knowledge of music and your love and appreciation for it. I think everybody listening is going to appreciate the same thing. I know you're not big on the socials, but like, you should let people know where they can find you. Like, what if they have a question about something and they need you to answer it? You have to be there.
Okay, yeah, no, I'm not crazy on the socials, but I do encourage you to give me a follow, AC Phobes. It's on Instagram, ACFFAUBS. I'm also a bit of an amateur playlist curator.
Yes, he is, but not amateur. He's a great one.
Yeah, so, you know, hit me up on there and I'll send you my playlist. I have different vibes for every mood. And yeah, thank you so much for having me. If I didn't fuck it up too bad, I would love to come back on and talk about another album that we can find that interests us both. I just wanted to say that you're doing a great job with this. Like I said, Michael and I work together, and he's mentioned that he's done this podcast, and you know, not actually, I wanted to mention, I've never told you this, but Backstreet Boys, that was my first concert, and I did have a Backstreet Boys poster in my room. I know that you think of me as like the hip hop guy, because that's the image that I like to portray, but I do have a history with the type of music that I know you love as well. So yeah. I'm sure we can find another common thread, but yeah, just in getting ready for this episode, I was listening to some of the past ones, and you're killing it. So keep it up.
Well, thank you, man. I appreciate that. I absolutely think we'll be able to find many, many more albums that we can talk like this about. But hey, anyone that you come up with, you always know I'm down and I'm game. And I just got to give you a little bit of a kick in the ass to get you to do it. And that's it.
But great day in the morning.
Yes, literally that. Well, thank you, my man. I appreciate you. And you guys, thank you for listening. Stay tuned. Next week, I'll be doing the My December album by Kelly Clarkson. And I know many of you guys have been wanting to hear everything about that record, because that one was very dramatic. So stay tuned for that one next week. But yeah, spend the day, get in your voodoo vibe, pull out your vinyl if you have it. If you don't, head over to the store and pick it up. Not sponsored, but it is an album that you need to own physically. I think it was intended to be listened to as an album from start to finish, as we said. So yeah, thank you guys so much. And I will see you next week. Bye. She didn't work it through. Don't work the rule that will not be reversed. Yeah. No. And then I go on.